This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajeem. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa السماوات وما في الأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده إلا بإذنه لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not. and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. has rejected a plea by UN officials to reverse a decision to declare Yemen's Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group. The U.S. imposes new sanctions on Chinese officials and firms over tensions in the South China Sea. Also coming up, the Pentagon warns that far-right and white supremacist extremists are actively recruiting in the U.S. military and have gained more support over the past year. Good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, the U.S. has rejected a plea by UN officials to reverse a decision to declare Yemen's Ansar Allah movement a terrorist group. The U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the UN said the designation would help move forward the political process to settle the Yemen conflict. Richard Mills was addressing a UN Security Council briefing that saw fierce criticism of the U.S. decision. On Sunday, Washington blacklisted the Ansar Allah movement, which controls northern Yemen. UN officials have opposed the designation, citing humanitarian impact and a dire consequence for the peace process in Yemen.
Mr. President, I am extremely concerned about the impact of the decision from the United States to designate Ansar Allah as a foreign terrorist organization. We fear, in my mission, that there will be inevitably a chilling effect on my efforts to bring the parties together.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen. In my opinion, the Gulf
states need to pick up the humanitarian... UN Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock also urged Washington to reverse its decision. He said Ansar Allah's designation could cause a famine not seen in the past four decades. The European Union also criticized the U.S., saying the designation could hinder aid deliveries to Yemen. The country has been devastated by the Saudi-led war that began in 2015. The U.N. has described Yemen the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansar Allah and its allied army units are fighting Riyadh that is backed by Washington. The Yemeni port of Hodeidah has been forcibly closed by the Saudi-led coalition since the start of the war on Yemen. The closure has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs and source of income, further exacerbating Yemeni's suffering. Our correspondent in Hodeidah, Abdel Latif al-Washali, has more.
The port of Hodeidah, which is the only outlet to the outside world for millions of Yemenis, is still suffering from a forced closure imposed by the Saudi-led coalition. This has caused thousands of workers to lose their jobs, increasing the rate of poverty and unemployment in the coastal governorate.
The workers at the port of Hodeidah include 3,500 workers in the port and 500 others in other fields of the port. They each support a family, and the closure of the port has eliminated the source of income of these people. The suspension of operations of the port has affected the lives of all Yemenis who depend on the port for the arrival of food and medicine.
This port is the only outlet for millions of Yemenis to receive essential supplies, and its continued closure means they can't easily have access to adequate food and medicine, not to mention the large economic losses for the Yemeni economy, estimated at over $1 billion.
The port of Hodeidah is one of the important ports in the Red Sea, and direct and indirect corporate losses are estimated at $1.24 billion in total. This is a large sum, since the Red Sea Ports Corporation is responsible for 70% of the imports sent to the 20 governorates for more than 20 million Yemenis.
Yemen has been suffering from a sea and air blockade since the Saudi-led coalition launched its war in March 2015, which has destroyed the country's infrastructure, killed tens of thousands of civilians and starved millions of women and their children. As the Saudi war on Yemen approaches its seventh year, Yemeni's calls for the demilitarization of Port of Hodeidah continue to be ignored by the United Nations and other relevant international organizations. From Port of Hodeidah, Abdul Latif Al-Washali.
Turning elsewhere now, the U.S. has imposed new sanctions on China for alleged misdeeds in the South China Sea. The measures put travel bans on an unspecified number of Chinese officials. They include executives of state-owned enterprises as well as military officials. Nine Chinese firms were also added to U.S. investment ban. Washington has accused the targeted entities of using coercion against states with rival South China Sea claims. Beijing has slammed the move. It has accused Washington of exploiting its state power to crack down on foreign companies. The sanctions are the latest in a series of measures by outgoing President Donald Trump's administration against China. The measures have escalated tensions between the two sides. Now, North Korea has displayed a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a military parade in the capital, Pyongyang. The missile was showcased as part of celebrations to mark the inauguration of the 8th Congress of the ruling Workers' Party. The parade also included the march of the Republic's elite units and rockets, which North Korean media describe as having powerful striking capabilities for thoroughly annihilating enemies outside the territory. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un addressed the assembly and decried the United States as the foremost principal enemy of his country. At least 34 people have been killed and dozens of others injured after a massive earthquake hit Indonesia's west Sulawesi. The epicenter of the magnitude 6.2 tremor was 6 kilometers northeast of the city of Majen at a depth of 10 kilometers. The quake came hours after a 5.9 magnitude tremor rocked the same district, damaging several houses. A hotel and the governor's office were among the buildings that sustained severe damage. The earthquake has razed a hospital to the ground, trapping staff and patients under the rubble. Indonesia's Disaster Mitigation Agency said thousands of residents have fled their homes to seek safety. Now, the Pentagon says far-right and white supremacist extremism in the U.S. military has increased over the past year. An unnamed senior military official said radical groups are actively recruiting U.S. military personnel into their cause. The official added that extremist groups are also encouraging their members to join the armed forces to acquire skills and experience. Active duty service members and veterans, as well as police officers, were among the U.S. president's supporters who stormed the Capitol last week. The Pentagon says it will launch an investigation into the extent of extremism in U.S. military ranks. This after 14 senators called for the, quote, alarming trend to be immediately addressed. Political activist Life Malcolm describes white supremacists as terrorists who have already always oppressed black people, not only in the U.S., but also in other parts of the world.
White people have been brilliant at naming and renaming, defining and redefining the reality that most people in the world live in. So there's no such thing as white supremacists, just colonialists and capitalists who've always been about the business of oppressing and exploiting African people and others around the world since they brought us here, since they invaded the shores of Haiti, Jamaica, and other areas of the world, since they stole the land here from the indigenous people, the so-called Mexicans and others. These people aren't supreme in any way, shape, or form or fashion. They're just terrorists, colonists, and capitalists who exploit people all around the world. This idea that the military is recruiting these people is also redefining that the capitalist, rather that the colonizer has been brilliant at, as I mentioned before. The domestic military, the police, is the breeding ground for the military that goes around the world and takes and spreads this kind of terror and brutality that in the name of so-called white supremacy.
We're going to stay in the United States, where a rehearsal for U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration has been reportedly postponed because of security concerns. The rehearsal was scheduled for Sunday, but now it is planned for a day later. That's according to two people with knowledge of the move. Biden's team has also canceled the Washington trip planned for Monday because of heightened security concerns. The United States is beefing up security in the capital city and other states ahead of Biden's inauguration on January the 20th. 20,000 National Guards have been deployed to Washington after the FBI warned of a major security threat. All these come in the wake of the breach of Congress by supporters of President Donald Trump last Wednesday. A senior leader of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units has condemned Washington's blacklisting of the group's deputy commander, Abu Fedek al-Muhammadawi. Faleh al-Fayyad, who himself was blacklisted by the U.S. days ago, said Washington's move amounts to a violation of Iraq's sovereignty. Fayyad added that the measure also ignores the Iraqi government and official institutions, as well as the decisions made by the Iraqi parliament. He also stressed that it would be unacceptable to put those who fight terrorists and Takfiri groups on a terror list. This comes as Baghdad has already condemned the blacklisting of Faleh al-Fayyad, who has repeatedly called for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. The Popular Mobilization Units is an official legal organization which operates under the command of the Iraqi Armed Forces. A prominent Israeli NGO has recently slammed the regime as an apartheid entity, pursuing an agenda of Jewish supremacy in the occupied Palestinian territories. The assessment of the Israeli behavior by Beit Salam was published by the British daily The Guardian. Needless to say, the revelations have won the author of the piece no friends in Tel Aviv.
Many people around the world have highly condemned the brutal actions of the Israeli regime against the people of Palestine, whilst others have simply turned a blind eye to the actions of the regime, as it does not suit their foreign policy requirements. But when the criticism comes from within, surely it's time to take heed. In a piece in the UK Daily, The Guardian, Israeli human rights group B'Tselem director Shirai Elad slammed the Israeli regime's treatment of Palestine as apartheid control, which, coming from Israel's largest human rights group and a Jewish author, is something that has rocked Tel Aviv, who have quickly blunted the comments via its embassy spokesman in London, Ohad Zemet. Elad goes on to claim that the Israeli regime is working solely to advance the supremacy of one group of people, namely the Jews, which is most ironic, as the Jewish people themselves claim to have once been victims to such treatment, yet fail to back Elad's allegations when it's they who are at fault. So bad has the situation become from the controlling of land and sea borders in Gaza to the endless slicing away of land in the West Bank, that Elad claims there's not a single square inch of territory where the notion of equality can be claimed between Palestinians and Jews, suggesting clear favoritism towards the Jewish people. With Israel about to enter its fourth election in just 2 years, the rights and voices of the people of Palestine are being suppressed, mostly through the calculated engineering of power by the Israeli regime against Palestinians, be it through political rights or pure and simple denial of rights. But it seems that the people of Palestine are not simply standing back and allowing the Israeli regime to quietly push them into a corner, with regular voices and demonstrations still taking place, opposing the so-called deal of the century, opposing the destruction of Palestinian homes, and opposing the Israeli regime's ongoing attempts to steal more and more Palestinian land.
Israel is no stranger when it comes to committing crimes against Palestinians, ranging from destruction of their homes to killings and the denial of their rights. All these are enough for the Israeli-based Salam to label the regime an apartheid practitioner. The raising of the apartheid behavior of the Israeli regime is no doubt a courageous act by the author. However, the question still remains as to why the international community still fails to allow Israeli actions to go unpunished, essentially encouraging the regime's behavior to continue unopposed.
In spite of the United Nations outlawing the Israeli regime from continuing to destroy Palestinian lands and occupy more Palestinian land in the process, the Israeli regime has brazenly ignored the law, hence both undermining an international organization such as the UN and the rights of the people of Palestine in the process. In fact, since the start of 2020, the Israeli regime has demolished over 700 Palestinian buildings, ranging from homes, schools, medical centers, and community buildings, under the faux pretext of lacking construction permits, which is ironic, as they were all built on Palestinian land, hence raising the question as to just which Israeli regime permit could they possibly need. On top of the destruction of Palestinian homes and buildings, it's also the lives of the people of Palestine that the Israeli regime feels it so liberally able to take away. In 2020 alone, at least 27 Palestinian civilians were murdered in cold blood by the Israeli regime. Seven were children, proving that the execution of Palestinians is something that the Israeli regime is also getting away with scot-free. So poor and brazen is the behavior of the Israeli regime that now even Jewish settlers are taking things into their own hands, emulating the crimes of their regime by raiding and attacking Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In fact, in 2020 alone, 248 attacks were committed by settlers, all of which have again gone unpunished and unnoticed across the international community. With the normalization of ties between the Israeli regime and the Arab nations such as Bahrain, the UAE and Morocco, it seems that the voices of opposition are being deafened by the regime's false diplomacy, meaning that the people and land of Palestine is being wiped out by the Israelis, and equally as bad, being forgotten by their Arab brothers and sisters around the region.
Turning elsewhere now, hospitals in Brazil's northern state of the Amazonas have run out of beds and oxygen supplies. The Brazilian health minister said the situation in the state is extremely serious, with its hospital system collapsing. Amazonas has announced a curfew to try to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The state, where nearly 6,000 people have died from COVID-19, is now suffering a devastating second wave that is pushing emergency services to a breaking point. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has been under pressure for downplaying the severity of the world's second deadliest COVID-19 outbreak. The South American country has registered over 8.3 million cases and more than 207,000 fatalities so far. China has reported 144 new COVID-19 cases in its mainland as the country continues to witness an upward trend in the number of infected people. The figure is the highest in more than 10 months. China also reported one COVID-related death on Thursday after 8 months. The recent increase in the number of new infections has prompted the country to strengthen its epidemic control and prevention measures over the past days by promoting mass testing, building centralized medical observation centers, and setting up the disinfection of imported goods. The coronavirus has taken over 4,600 lives and infected nearly 88,000 people in the country. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
the limelight.
It is about a new political formation called Trumpism, with its mix of white supremacy, voter suppression, market fundamentalism, and authoritarianism. Trumpism will have an afterlife long after Trump leaves the White House, says Henry A. Girox, writer, in an article published under the heading, Attack on Capitol Affirms Trumpism Will Live On After Trump Leaves White House. Stay tuned for more. The storming of the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. by a mob of President Donald Trump supporters, Trump's condemnation of Vice President Mike Pence for refusing to intervene in the election process, and the attempt by a number of Republican politicians to promote conspiracy theories and dangerous propaganda provided yet another example that Americans no longer live in the shadow of authoritarianism and have tipped over into the abyss. Under Trump's rule, lies, ignorance, encouragement of white supremacy, and a thirst for violence have taken on a more lethal direction. Within the last few years, it has moved from violence waged against immigrants, black and brown people, and the poor, to the violence of a right-wing mob attacking the police, rampaging through the Capitol and occupying the House and Senate chambers. Trump not only advertised a call for a demonstration among his supporters, he also brought to the event a history of encouraging his supporters to express themselves through violence. The mob's actions followed a speech in which Trump once again claimed the election was fraudulent and he urged the crowd to march on the Capitol. What Trump and the mob shared was their hatred of democracy, however fragile, and the discredited belief that the election was stolen. In the aftermath of the mob violence, Trump sent out a series of tweets supporting the actions of the violent mob, only to be later removed by Twitter. At the same time, the demonstratic and domestic terrorism that took place on January 6th was about more than Trump's lies and his use of language in the service of violence. It is also about a new political formation called Trumpism, with its mix of white supremacy, voter suppression, market fundamentalism, and authoritarianism. Trumpism will have an afterlife long after Trump leaves the White House. This counter-revolution had been building for years in the dark recess of conspiracy theories, lies, white rage, and hatred of those considered enemies of the people. This was Trumpism in full bloom, with all of its ignorance, hatred, and penchant for lawlessness on full display. But it also testified to the notion that fascism begins with language and ends with violence. The mob violence aimed at shutting down the counting of electoral ballots was reminiscent of the thugs that roamed the streets of Germany in 1930s, attempting to brutalize dissenters and those considered other in the absurd Nazi notion of racial and political cleansing. Trump has unleashed his fascist impulses consistently through the language of violence and divisiveness, aided by the right-wing media such as Fox News, Breitbart, and others. Under the Trump administration, ignorance has turned lethal. Moreover, as David Teo Goldberg has argued, politics today is nothing short of a civil war, marked by divisions and disunity in which life for most of the inhabitants of the United States becomes both unbearable and dangerous. Trumpism is the culmination of a cultural and fascist politics that has been evolving and intensifying for years through the incitement of lies, conspiracy theories, and the heated rhetoric of racism and a brutal war on the welfare state and working class people. The acts of domestic terrorism on display in the storming of the Capitol reach far beyond the toxic personal politics, incompetency, and corruption of Trump himself. Such violence has a long history in the U.S. and has been normalized under the aegis of Trumpism as a right-wing populist movement which Trump brought to the surface of American politics as a badge of honor. The violence in Washington, D.C. did not begin with the march by right-wing fanatics and white supremacists. It erupted more openly with Trump in 2016 when he seized upon and manipulated the fears of powerless whites and white supremacists who imagined themselves as under siege and as oppressed outsiders. For 4 years, he has incited violence through attempts to inspire and energize his white supremacists and fascist followers. Every era produces a language and cultural markers that offer insights into its politics, values, and vision of the past, present, and future. This is especially true regarding the economic, public, and cultural influence of the Trump's presidency and mode of governance. Trumpism is not limited to the personal behavior of Trump. It refers less to a person, to a dangerous movement and social base that operates as a social pathology whose endpoint is the destruction of democracy itself. As a new cultural and political construct, Trumpism merges a ruthless capitalist rationality, widening inequality and a commitment to white supremacy. These forces have deep historical roots in the United States. However, what is distinctive is that they have congealed into a unique political and cultural formation under the Trump regime, marked by an emotively charged, spectacularized, and updated form of authoritarianism that echoes elements of a fascist past. In the current historical moment, Trumpism has intensified and quickened the dark forces of hate, racism, ultra-nationalism, and white nationalism. Trumpism has accelerated the culture of fear while using a variety of tools of repression, ranging from mass incarceration, surveillance, and police brutality to a full-fledged attack on those who would bring reality into play and hold power accountable, to enforce a worldview in which lawlessness and political corruption have become the order of the day. As the enemy of democracy, Trumpism is a mix of a capacious authoritarian ideology, a right-wing propaganda machine, and a fascist ethos. Its power and influence far exceed Trump's presidency, and it will not come to an end with the election of Biden. In its afterlife, it will continue to sabotage democracy in the name of minority rule, and its only endpoint is the tyranny of authoritarianism. As an anti-democratic ethos, it has opened a political chasm in which any attempt to unify the nation appears almost impossible. Trump's relentless politics of divisiveness is a toxic platform for inciting violence, affirming a culture of cruelty, and promoting a politics of exclusion and racial purification. Trumpism exhibited no concern for the unnecessary deaths of hundreds of thousands of infected and dying from COVID-19. All the more appalling since the deadly effects of the raging pandemic were largely the result of the bungling leadership of an administration that chose conspiracy theories over science, replaced the authority of public health officials with Fox News incompetence, and lied about the severity of a virus that spread through the population and across the globe like an out-of-control wildfire. As a death-dealing form of cultural politics, Trumpism further removed the government from any sense of social responsibility. Trumpism is focused on not only capturing institutions of the state for personal and political gain, but also redefining and controlling language, the social media, and popular culture as a way of emptying politics of any substance by turning it into a spectacle. Language now operates in the service of violence, and all forms of criticism are relegated to the category of fake news, unworthy of serious reflection or critical analysis. Trumpism, at its core, is a cultural politics that shreds any viable notion of shared values, national unity, and in doing so, transforms essential human connections into bonds of distrust and fear. It views the space of the social common good and demonic values as a register of weakness and resentment, bristling with hatred, if not a seething logic of disposability. Trumpism reached into every niche and crack of civil and political society, and in doing so, cross-pollinated politics, culture, and everyday life with a range of right-wing policies. Authoritarian impulses and the emerging presence of right-wing movements. Under Trumpism, the centrality of education to politics became obvious with the growing use of 21st century cultural apparatuses such as Twitter, Facebook, Google, along with media outlets such as Fox News, Newsmax, and Breitbart. These pedagogical apparatuses produced a distinctive cultural space that feathered the marriage of power and manufactured civic illiteracy and worked to eliminate the crucial question of what civic education and literacy should accomplish in a democracy. Favoring instant reactions and a culture of immediacy, the new media and new image-based cultural forms turned chaos, catastrophe, and collapse into a spectacle that called forth instant gratification along with a kind of digital sublime in which such platforms are mythologized as both convenient and infallible. Trumpism performs politics as a form of entertainment and digital drama. It does so by transforming the political realm and society into a form of spectacularized theater, not unlike what French theorists said, a society of a spectacle. As a right-wing cultural apparatus, spectacle of disintegration, a tribal ethos, Trumpism politics became an all-out encompassing tool of propaganda and pedagogy of repression, functioning as a form of cultural politics under the control of a corporate elite. As a reactionary cultural conduit, Trumpism undermines critical dialogue, shared values, shared responsibilities, and informed judgments, while promoting authoritarian narratives that disdain historical consciousness, critical thinking, and the idea, if not principles, of participatory democracy. Hard boundaries, precarity, a culture of fear, untrampled individualism, an all-encompassing ethos of self-help, and a profound unease constitute the currency of Trumpism. In this instance, economic justice, meaningful solidarities, and the common good are removed from the discourse of politics and citizenship.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
There's no doubt that the military aggression against Lebanon became inaccessible to the pattern adopted by the Israeli enemy since 1978, which acquired another form of aggression that targeted the supporters of the resistance in the only country that has so far defeated Israel. All plans failed, so Washington decided to suffocate the allies and supporters of the resistance by implementing economic sanctions and by designating Hezbollah an international criminal terrorist organization, all while supporting the largest terrorist entity on the planet, Israel. This new plan required making judicial arguments, assembling files, and falsely linking them together to establish the party's involvement in terrorism and drug crimes on the one hand, and assigning Israel's proxies in the U.S. administration to oversee the implementation of penalties and prosecute people alleged to be affiliated with the party. Their last attempt at sabotaging any entity related to or affiliated with Hezbollah was hacking the party's Al-Qard al-Hassan financial institution. Qard al-Hassan is a 36-year-old association that grants small loans with zero interest to help borrowers manage their life hardships, like rebuilding houses, opening small businesses, and covering marriage hardships, regardless of their religious affiliations. Despite the institution's assurance that hackers had no access to any of the internal data or account numbers of depositors, the hackers till this day keep posting Excel sheets that anyone can fill or scanned files of depositors' IDs or procuration papers. All the leaked documents were scanned photos, obviously taken from a certain folder of the internal administrative communication database between the different departments of each branch and between branches. It was not that of the actual database of the depositors' account details. Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah clarified last week that Al-Qard al-Hassan Association gives loans on the basis of mortgaged gold or a mutual guarantor between the borrower and the association, and in no way or form does it fund Hezbollah. Another plan to twist the arm of the resistance falters. Actually, it gave a great marketing push for the association, which saw a considerable turnout of new depositors to open accounts after the speech of Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Hezbollah, which has been suffering from 4 years of Trump's maximum pressure campaign against its resistance forces, is hesitant to show optimism following Joe Biden's presidential election victory. Washington's approach resulted in multiple sanctions on Hezbollah members and companies linked to the political bloc. Add to that, high probability of hostilities continue to materialize on the border with occupied Palestine, making the chances of a sudden escalation increase steadily. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Saleh. Now, Lebanon's economy is highly dollarized, Dr. Saleh, which gives Washington a tremendous leverage to use economic sanctions to deter the Lebanese public from supporting their own resistance back home, the liberation movement in Lebanon. The U.S. has managed to target several political allies of the resistance in Lebanon as well. Now, do you think that they might move forward towards targeting civilians now, or rather just back off after maybe Trump just leaves office?
Well, hi. I guess the United States has used all what it has in order to put down the ambience of Hezbollah, the popularity of Hezbollah. Fortunately, they did not succeed, especially the people, the environment, are embracing this resistance, highly embracing this resistance, and the speeches of Sayyid Nasrallah last one and before the last show this confidence of the people in the region towards the resistance. So I guess the Americans, whatever they use of their instruments or sanctions, the resistance was and still able to overcome all these silly decisions from the American administration, especially
one of the major targeted associations that were linked to Hezbollah and lately targeted, maybe late 2020, was the Qard al-Hassan Association, which is a financial institute that gives out interest-free loans and allows for commission-free deposits. This association was hacked, and I actually spoke with the directors of Qard al-Hassan, who are not doing any media interviews so far up until now, but they told me that the hacked server was that which was used for internal administrative communication between the branches and between departments of one branch in particular. So it was not that of the actual database of the depositors' accounts information, rather just Excel sheets that anyone could actually put out there, and maybe a couple of scanned files, which include maybe IDs and procuration papers. Do you think that this is enough damage to affect the reputation of such an institution and at least maybe shake its reputation in front of the depositors?
Well, I believe the statements was made by Al Qard Al Hassan managerial committee, and that would not influence the clients of Al Qard Al Hassan, and the people, they have a sufficient confidence of this institution, which helps poor, helps students and doctors and people who want to have a loan in order to buy a car. This is very small thing, I guess, in terms of the people, especially in this crisis. You mentioned the economic crisis in Lebanon. However, I would say Al Qard Al Hassan accelerated its activities. The people now, as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, the people would go to Al Qard Al Hassan and put deposit in this bank, their only bank without interest, and they have full confidence with of their money that it's in a safe place. That's why I guess all the these hackers could not influence the trust or even influence the Al Qard Al Hassan institution and the programs, the computer programs. They issued this statement. People were relieved, and they are having this good relationship between the clients and the managerial committee.
Mind you, we should also remind the people that it's at times when the people's money are actually locked up in the actual banks
in the
of
banks,
Lebanon.
Yes,
at the same time, it's a secure place for them to invest. But going back to the sanctions and the pressure against Hezbollah, we had Biden stating that when he takes office in at least like 7 or 8 days, he will end Trump's maximum pressure policy against Tehran, hence against all the allies of the resistance in the region. Why is Hezbollah still very hesitant of showing any signs of optimism following Biden's victory?
Well, we have been taught, we have been really earned a lot of knowledge about these administrations, whether the Democrats or the Republicans. If we don't see any advantages from any of them, so we can't talk about good intentions from these presidents. So let's wait and see. Biden and Obama, his president, he was vice president of Obama, did not show any good intentions towards Iran or towards Lebanon. But I guess the balance of power now in the whole world is changing. Mm-hmm. Probably would the Americans go back to their mind and let the peoples determine their self-identity and self-independent and their autonomy and their slogans and their way of life. I guess that needs to be waited until Biden can really be there in the White House.
We don't know if he's going to make it or not. One more threat is out there in the face of all Lebanese people is Israel. It keeps threatening a resumption of full-fledged hostilities against the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, but mainly against all of Lebanon here. But especially they keep saying that in the near future. They keep repeating that word. But, I mean, its leaders were obviously disappointed by the loss of Trump in the election, and they basically have lost their main, maybe, focal point of normalization in the region in West Asia. Is a full-fledged war against Hezbollah a viable option for Israel at this point in time?
Absolutely not. They have tried many times in many wars against Hezbollah and against Lebanon, and they failed in all these wars. So I guess they are trying to maneuver the psychology of people, but the people in the south and in all Lebanon, they challenge these statements from Netanyahu or from some of its soldiers, but I guess the upper hand is for the resistance in this region, especially in the south. And I guess this maneuver would not help them. Otherwise, they will be the losers in any coming war. If they try to attack any place in Lebanon, even they can't escape even the avenge of Hezbollah for one fighter martyred in Syria. How could they dare to do such a war? I really further say that they can't and they would not do that.
Well, we have to test maybe and see whether these threats are going to be actually viable or not. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mohsen Saleh, political commentator, for joining us in Beirut to talk about the maximum pressure game that Washington is playing with the axis of resistance and namely Hezbollah in the region. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about the new agreement in the PGCC.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Qatar will not halt or make concessions in its relationships with Iran. This is what the Qatari foreign minister declared last week following a solidarity and stability agreement that was signed by Persian Gulf leaders in a landmark summit that took place in the ancient desert city of Al-Ula. Saudi Arabia and its allies have restored full relations with Qatar, ending a huge rift that erupted 3 years ago. New Persian Gulf ties in this following report.
The end of the so-called Persian Gulf Rift would constitute a major regional step to adopt a foreign policy that is more attuned to the sensitivities of the other members and thus moderate eventual excesses. This was evident when Qatar declared that it will not alter its relations with Iran last week following a solidarity and stability agreement that was signed by the Persian Gulf leaders in a summit that took place in the ancient desert city of Al-Ula. Saudi Arabia and the UAE reconciling with Qatar is a sign that the latter has made few concessions after securing a deal to break the blockade against its borders. Another important development could be vis-à-vis the relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Qatar's connections with the Persian power are well known and could be used as a means for an anti-Semitic rapprochement in the region of West Asia. Many people have already forgotten that the rift started in 2017 with serious policy differences over how the countries of the Persian Gulf should deal with Iran and treat the Muslim Brotherhood groups contending for influence in the war on Syria. As the rifts begin to heal with this new announcement, the underlying differences have not really been resolved. The parties, at least, have agreed to end the rift's more visible and disruptive effects. The ripple effect of the PGCC internal rivalries has been central to the proxy dynamics that have underpinned and shaped the outcomes of political and military developments across the region of West Asia and North Africa since the popular uprisings began in 2011. Despite the purported rapprochement between Persian Gulf parties, it is worth noting that this is seemingly influenced by a desire to preempt pressure from an incoming Biden administration more than a genuine commitment to conflict resolution. As such, the agreement within the PGCC is very unlikely to significantly affect geopolitical dynamics beyond the states involved. Third-party states such as Libya, Tunisia, Sudan, Morocco, and Egypt will remain theaters where Persian Gulf players and their allies will continue their proxy interventionism and their scramble to settle geopolitical scores.
To discuss this issue with us from London is Sami Hamdi, Editor-in-Chief of the International Interest. Thank you for being with us, Sami, to discuss this new agreement between the Persian Gulf states, between Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and also Egypt is there. They cited Doha's ties to Iran and Turkey as core reasons for their extraordinary decision back in 2017 to cut diplomatic and transport links to Qatar. Yet today, after the new signed agreement between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the former still insists that it will not change its relationship with Iran. So what was the point of the severance to begin with?
I think it's important to remember or to highlight that the blockade had nothing to do with Qatar's relations with Iran or any of the 13 conditions that were imposed, except when it comes to Al Jazeera's coverage. The blockade was imposed primarily because Saudi Arabia, UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain were essentially very worried and very concerned by Qatar's ongoing support for movements lean more towards the popular desire, whether that's in Tunisia, whether that's in Libya. By that, I don't necessarily mean that Qatar supported democracy or democratic trends, but that Qatar supported a movement that threatened the regimes of Saudi Arabia, of UAE, of Egypt, and Bahrain. And I think the Iran point was more to try to get the US on board, to get Trump on board, as opposed to anything seriously regarding Qatar and Iran's relationship.
Well, that's really interesting, Sami, because it's being propagated on most Western mainstream media that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the kingdom's actual day-to-day ruler, wanted to resolve the rift to gain credibility with the upcoming Biden administration in the US. What is Mohammed bin Salman afraid of here? So, I mean, Biden becomes president and he is still at war with Qatar. What would happen then? Who cares?
I think the Democrats have always been averse to Mohammed bin Salman following the murder of Khashoggi. They've been averse to Saudi Arabia's role in the war in Yemen and the humanitarian crisis and the inability of the Saudis to bring about a resolution either by peace or either by military solution in Yemen. The U.S. is not really interested in peace. It's always interested in who the winner is. But given there is no winner and given that there is a humanitarian crisis, there is a fear that the Democrats will implement retrospective punitive measures on Mohammed bin Salman. Mm-hmm. Mohammed bin Salman believes that Al Jazeera and Qatar's extensive media outlets in English and in Arabic have played a key role in fueling anti-bin Salman sentiment in Washington. Their lobbying networks, very influential, have influenced attitudes in Washington towards Mohammed bin Salman. That's bin Salman's perspective, by the way, not necessarily mine, which is that bin Salman's actions naturally bring about...
I wanted to say that, because basically there are war crimes in Yemen.
So a deal from the Qataris that the media outlets will be quiet, that they will give him some peace, and this is about shelving contentious issues, including Yemen, where we saw the formation of a government and a willingness to now negotiate with the Houthis, including this idea that bin Salman now is trying to shelve any contentious issue that might draw antagonism from Biden. And this is why it's important to note, if Trump had won, it's very unlikely we would have seen any reconciliation at all.
Exactly. Well, also, we have many analysts, especially regional ones, saying that DOE in particular had been reluctant with regard to the rapprochement that happened with Qatar, partly because of Abu Dhabi's concerns about Qatar's growing relationship with Turkey as the power struggle between the two states intensified last year, specifically in Libya, for example. But what changed UAE's mind? I mean, could there be any benefit for them out of this reconciliation right now?
The UAE's power in the region is under